The dean of Illinois State University's new College of Engineering wants to make diversity a priority. It's something he's well positioned to do.
This is a luxury that most people don't get, is I get to hire everybody.
ISU's aim to host the state's first equity-focused College of Engineering is next on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm John Norton. Also on the show today, District 87 schools will start social-emotional learning earlier, next year in grade school.
Coming out of COVID, it's one of those things where we've recognized the need to focus on social-emotional learning. I mean, that's part of what we do today.
Plus, Bloomington Normal loves to eat out and apparently likes it to go.
If you could build a building that had 10 drive-through windows for 10 different restaurants, you'd be making a lot of money.
Those stories follow a Bloomington Normal news update, which is just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. Hear My Story continues with local patient Jerry Newkirk.
The individuals in there have chances to make weapons. The way that they sharpen metal objects is to grind them on the concrete floors. And I'm able to pick up that grinding now.
Jerry's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
From the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. Good evening, I'm John Norton. District 87 expects to have an additional opening on its school board soon, weeks before voters go to the polls to elect three new members. Fitzgerald Samdy has told district officials he plans to resign. Samdy was sentenced to probation and veterans court after his fourth drunk driving conviction. District 87 Superintendent David Mauser tells WGLT's Eric Stock the district is waiting for his official resignation.
He's worked to serve the board like everyone else has. He's been absent the last several board meetings, and obviously there's been some things going on there with him. So, you know, we wish him the best as he moves on and moves forward, and I think there's just a lot of work for us to focus on. But our relationship has been positive. I have nothing negative to say.
Would you have been pushing for him to resign if he hadn't made that decision on his own, or were there factors, other people talking to him to encourage him to step down?
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, ultimately, you know, there's some statutes in play where, you know, if somebody is convicted of a felony or something like that, they can't serve in a public office. We're aware of some of those kinds of things. So we're working to find out exactly what that all entails. But really, you know, everybody is innocent until, otherwise. And so, you know, we didn't want to make any assumptions and certainly wanted to allow him the opportunity to go through the process, which he's done now. And so we'll have further conversations and move on from it.
What are you looking for in a new school board member?
Well, I think it's just like every time we have a school board member come on board, you're looking for people that are interested in, furthering the opportunities for students. And so, you know, you look for people with diverse backgrounds. It's always a positive. So from what I can tell right now, we've got a great, set of candidates running for our school board for the April election. We've got people that are dedicated and interested. We've got some incumbents that are outstanding. And so, you know, really what it comes down to is just people that are willing to serve for kids and, come in with an agenda that is focused on the betterment of our school district.
So how is your first year at District 87 gone so far?
It's going great. My background is that I was at Tri-Valley as a superintendent for the last several years, was a high school principal there before that. I was lucky in that I got to work with Dr. Riley, on several committees and on different efforts prior to coming in. So I was really, and growing up in McLean County, and I was very aware of District 87 and the good work that's done. So no, it's been, there's been a learning curve, in terms of just the day-to-day and the operations and how things differ in a larger district. But this has been an unbelievable experience for me. I have grown a ton. I've learned a lot, and I'm thrilled to be where we are right now.
The District 87 School Board has approved a new social-emotional learning curriculum for K through 5 students. What will that entail?
You know, it's really just about making sure that our focus is aligned all the way through. So it's this idea of seven mindsets is the curriculum that we're using. And really it's about, making sure that students have the skill sets and the toolbox to be able to, to navigate the day-to-day. And so, we kind of integrate that and weave that into our curriculum. But ultimately what it provides is a continuum that goes all the way through. So there's consistent language that our teachers and kids are able to use as we talk about the social emotional learning pieces that, you know, have become part of what we do in school. So, you know, whether you're in kindergarten all the way up through high school now, we've kind of got an integrated program that we believe will help our teachers, be able to address the social emotional needs and then provide the curriculum and resources associated.
Have you seen success at the grades 6 through 12 level since they've had it a little bit longer?
You know, I think that remains to be seen. You know, and it depends on how you define success. I think for us being able to provide that material so that it's, cohesive all the way through is what's really important right now. So we'll be assessing that as part of our curriculum team as the year goes on and certainly, you know, talk about how it's being utilized, what ways it's most effective, and then we'll continue within service for our teachers as well to make sure that they're maximizing the curriculum.
And this will not take away from actual instruction time?
Well, no. This is part of, it's integrated within what we do. So you think about, advisory periods and things like that, especially in junior high. That's the kind of time when it's being utilized. But, you know, when you talk about things like instructional time, I assume you're talking about, math and English and your core curriculum that we would normally think of. And no, we're not taking away from that at all. Those are still areas of focus.
As we continue with David Mauser, District 87 Superintendent, there were new guidelines that came out recently from the American Academy of Pediatrics that call for much stronger interventions for child obesity. That includes even medications for children 12 and over. As an educator, what do you make of that? Is there anything that you believe that schools should consider in that regard?
You know, ultimately, what I think we need, what we focus on here is we tell our teachers, focus on the child in front of you in the classroom, in the moment, real time on each day. When you do that, the academics takes care of them, take care of themselves. If we're focused on the curriculum and doing what we need to catch kids up, and get them where they need to be, really a lot of these things we're able to move forward with. So, when it comes to this, for example, we're always going to follow guidelines. When it comes to nutrition and things like that and school lunches, those are things that we'll always adhere to and we'll follow the guidelines that we're supposed to adhere to. But, I really don't have a strong opinion on how schools need to step up and be part of that process.
To be clear, it's not calling for schools to do anything in particular. In fact, it's more family-focused and child-focused, but just wondering from an educator standpoint, I'm wondering in particular about nutrition in schools, since you had alluded to that. Is there a way to get more fresh, healthy foods into a classroom, or rather into a school?
That's something we're always talking about. I think when you talk about our nutrition programs, it's really about maximizing the commodity usage and kind of the commodity programs and what the state helps us to be able to do. So, those are things that will be part of the discussion as we move forward and trying to figure out ways that we can provide healthy options for our kids on a daily basis in a cost-effective way. So that's always kind of always something that we're discussing.
And as you come to Bloomington Normal this year, obviously one of the major issues in this community right now is the deficit that Unit 5, your neighbor, is dealing with right now. They had a referendum, of course, that failed. They're looking to get that again. As a Unit 5 graduate yourself, as a neighbor to this school district, how are you thinking about that as a Unit 5 struggles with this issue and looks to build support for what it wants to do?
I've been asked this question several times. Obviously not being part of Unit 5 right now, it's I feel for what they're going through, and I think I'm always going to say the same thing, and that's that I'm kid focused. I want what's best for kids. And so, I don't think it's best for kids to cut their programs and activities and extracurriculars. I recognize that's the reason a lot of kids come to school and connect. And so, I think anytime we're in a situation where we're talking about cutting kids programs for kids, and then staff, it's concerning, right? And so I think obviously a structural deficit is a difficult situation. It's one that in many cases you can see coming, and obviously they did. And they've been, with the referendum failing and them going forward again, obviously I've seen the I've seen the narrative and I've seen a lot of what's going on. What I would tell people is, take the time to research on your own. Take the time to find out exactly what it is that they're looking to do. I'm supportive of them. I'm supportive of our neighbors. I'm supportive of kids and I'm supportive of their program. So, I wish nothing but the best for them, but I also understand it's a heavy lift.
That was District 87 Superintendent David Mauser and WGLT's Eric Stock. This is Sound Ideas, WGLT's news magazine. I'm John Norton. Illinois State University has taken on a tall task, creating the first equity-focused College of Engineering in the state. Things are on track for a 2025 launch so far. Thomas Kaiser of the Oregon Institute of Technology has just signed on to be the College of Engineering's founding dean. Kaiser and ISU Provost Andave Tarhuli outlines the vision and the next steps with WGLT's Lindsay Jones.
It is a dream job. I've mentioned this before, but I haven't mentioned it here. Is, you know, I really enjoy my current job, and I really wasn't looking for a change. But the recruiters convinced me to take a look at Illinois State and what they were starting. And when I looked, I'm like, wow, this is really worth investigating. And then I was a pleasure of being interviewed, and Provost Tarhuli laid out the plans very specifically and provided me some more information, and even was detailed in the budget. And it was just, yeah, it's a dream. It's a once in a career job. I'm looking forward to it.
One of the things about any department is the strengths that each individual member brings and the differences that set them apart from the other colleagues. How do you ensure that you build the right chemistry with the staff that is hired from day one to make the department as strong as it can be?
This is a luxury that most people don't get. Is I get to hire everybody, you know, we'll start with the department chairs this summer. From there, we'll work on some administrative support, diversity director. You know, having that, the ability to sort of hire somebody for a team and explain the direction, and is real luxury. You know, I've moved from a variety of different positions at different places, and usually you're sort of, these are the people that you get, and you work with them, and they're always great, right? But it's not, you don't have the luxury of sort of talking to them and sort of getting a feel for how they're going to fit into the team and knowing, sort of putting that, you know, you alluded to it, putting that puzzle together to make sure everybody has the right attributes. And, you know, one of the things I want my college to really believe in, and it's been shown nationally to be true, was, you know, engineering used to be defined as sort of like the guy with the grinding wheel and sparks spraying out. And that's great. You know, and engineers still do that for manufacturing processes. But as engineers, we need to sell ourselves and believe in ourselves, because we are people that make a difference in people's lives. And so making the right sort of environment, the right feel, instilling curiosity, all sorts of things in our students, letting them be entrepreneurial in their studies, is all sort of a new, sort of a big package we're going to put together to make ourselves attractive. You know, our first hires will be those department chairs, and, you know, off we go from there.
Are there any particular traits you're looking for as you fill the department up?
Yeah, there's going to be several. I mean, you know, I've always prided myself as being a hard worker. I know I'm never the smartest person in the room, so I compensate for that with some hard work. And I you know, will look for some very driven individuals for those initial positions and every position. But, you know, one of the things that I'm going to look for is the commitment to hiring diverse faculty. There's a direct correlation between what your faculty composition is and the composition of the student body. And, you know, one of the big things that was in every document I read when I was interviewing and after that is that we want to be known for diversifying the workforce, in particular in engineering. And so nationally, institutions graduate about 14% of students from underrepresented groups in engineering. In the Midwest, it's even less than that. And so, you know, I'm going to look for a real commitment for us to make a real impact in that. You know, I've told Provost Tarhuli, one of the ways we'll measure that is when other universities come visit us and see what we've done. And so I'm looking forward to that day.
The idea of an equity-focused program is a great one. And if it was easy, I would think that there would be some model that existed already that perhaps we'd be drawing from. But ISU seems to be hoping to kind of set the model. Do you expect any challenges in being like the first to kind of design a department, a design a program with this in mind, as well as academic rigor?
Yeah, there's always going to be challenges. But there are a lot of proven examples in science and in engineering that can be used. You know, I talked about hiring faculty that will represent what we want our student body to be. But along that line is all the support we have to do. And I'm a big believer we need to meet students where they are. You know, when I first went to college, they didn't care if we graduated or not, to be honest with you. They could always get more students, but that's not where we are as engineers and engineering educators anymore. So when students are interested in our college, we need to meet them where they are. And if they need to have some leveling courses, so be it. Other things that, you know, for support, we'll want to have active student organizations, whether that be, you know, the IEEE, which is for electrical engineers, or ASME for mechanical engineers. But we also want to have active organizations like Society of Black Engineers and the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers.
One of the many aspects of equity can be boiled down to financial equity and access. Is that going to be part of the founding of this department at all, like making sure that not only is recruitment up to par, but also is access to the schooling going to be available?
One of the things that we have built very intentionally in this planning also is the financial support to students with financial need. So we are dedicating, planning on dedicating just over $500,000 a year in scholarships to students to support them, be able to afford. So in a four-year period, and this is internal university money, in a four-year period, we fully intend to spend over $2 million. And a large chunk of that money will be dedicated to recruiting and helping support students from underserved populations using through some of those programming that Tom described.
That's Thomas Kaiser, the inaugural dean of ISU's proposed College of Engineering, and Provost Andave Tarhouli, speaking with WGLT's Lindsay Jones. Sad Ideas, WGLT's news magazine, stories and conversations around Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County. We're about a month into the new year, and Larry Carius is already a busy guy. He covers the Bloomington, Normal restaurant scene on his popular Facebook page. In this interview with WGLT's Ryan Denham, Carius says he is already tracking 11 planned restaurant openings this year, with more surely to come.
Last year, we had 30 restaurants open, 14 closed. So 30 restaurants at, that's 2.5 restaurants opening a month. I would put that in the good restaurant year category for Bloomington Normal.
So for 2023, this year, what of these 11 are we looking forward to? Can you walk me through a couple of them?
Sure. We have some firsts coming in. We have Nam Nam Ramen Chop. This is going into the VFW. You can buy ramen in quite a few restaurants in town, but this is the first ramen shop. This will be exclusively ramen. Another first that we have coming in, it is the Colab, and it's going in downtown Bloomington. I think many people will remember the restaurant as Kelly's Bakery. Shannon downtown was there for a short time. They're bringing in a restaurant called the Colab. It's a collaboration. And this is the first time I can recall where we'll have two separate restaurants operating out of one location. This will be the same owner. One will be called Under Wrap, where it will be featuring wraps. And the other one is Alla Tavalla. And Alla Tavalla is going to be Italian street food. And it's going to be almost exclusively a delivery.
So as we look back on 2022, which you described as a good restaurant year overall, what were some of the biggest stories from 2022, would you say?
The two biggest stories on Bloomington Normal restaurant scene, number one was when Green Gables was destroyed by fire, but number two, when I announced this fall that Green Gables was going to be rebuilding. So number one and two is Green Gables. Some of the other stories, Ozark House closing after 50 years.
Yes, speaking of Ozark House, you know, that was one of the oldest restaurants in Bloomington Normal at 50 years old when it closed. Now that they have closed, which places have bragging rights now as the oldest, like most established, still operating restaurants in town?
We do have some old restaurants, but broke them down into ones that have been owned by the same person or the same family, and then old restaurants that had changed ownership over the years. The non-chain restaurants that are still operated by the original owner or family, Grady's Pizza, 63 years. Avanti's in Normal, 51 years. Denny's Donuts on South Main Street, 48 years. Pub 2, 48 years. Muggsy's, 35 years. Janet's Cakes and Catering, 34 years. Mandarin Garden House, 32 years. And Shooter's Ride the Nine, 31 years. Oh, I don't think I included Fat Albert's in Gridley. He's owned that for, like, well, I guess 44 years.
You know, any restaurant that's been around, you know, 50 or more years has obviously navigated some topsy-turvy times. What are you hearing these days about, you know, what are some of the biggest challenges facing restaurant owners in Bloomington Normal today?
Number one, the real positive part for the restaurants, that the customers have come back after the COVID pandemic, but there are some problems. They can't find enough help. Ryan, I'm almost sure you can walk into any restaurant in this town, and if you look like you'd be a reliable employee, you would be hired. Restaurants need a lot of help. Another problem that they're having, that the increased costs, the food supplies and the utilities, and most restaurants have had to raise prices. And I tell people, in the old days, when you saw a new menu in a restaurant, it was because they had worn out. Now, when you see a new menu in a restaurant, it's probably because they raised prices.
Oh, so you've talked about some of the places that are going to be opening in 2023. What are some of those things that are really high on the wish list for incoming restaurant owners or entrepreneurs who want to open a space? They're looking for the right location. What are they looking for there?
I know several realtors in town, and from what they tell me, Ryan, if you could build a building that had 10 drive-through windows for 10 different restaurants, you'd be making a lot of money. Everybody's looking for a building with a drive-through window. If you really start looking around, there are no empty buildings that have drive-through windows. And then, you know, I will get calls from restaurant people outside of town. They'll ask me for the names of restaurants that have closed because they want to come to Bloomington Normal, but they want a closed restaurant where all the, you know, most of the equipment's there, the grease trap, the hood, all the major expenses are there, where they don't have the money to spend $500,000 or more to open a restaurant, but they do want a closed restaurant. They come in, do a little remodeling, clean up, paint, decor, and open it up. So if you see a closed restaurant that has not been reopened by another restaurant, it usually means there's been people aren't willing to pay what the lease price is.
That's Larry Carius, who runs the popular Bloomington Normal Restaurant Scene Facebook page. He spoke with WGLT's Ryan Denham. And that is Sound Ideas today. WGLT's news magazine is made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm John Norton with story help today from WGLT's Eric Stock, Lindsay Jones, and Ryan Denham. The show is produced by Samantha Hill. This is 89.1 FM, WGLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.